and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Shame often presents in our clients as tension, discomfort, strong emotions like anxiety, depression, even suicidal ideation. It can be easily overlooked and go unattended to by even the most well-intentioned of therapists. But the truth is that when shame infiltrates the bodies, the brains, the nervous systems of our clients, it leaves deeply embedded wounds, wounds that talk therapy can't always easily get to. So despite your best efforts, internalized shame has a negative impact on our traumatized clients' ability to find relief and take perspective, even with a good therapist and a strong therapeutic alliance. These feelings of worthlessness and inadequacy interfere with taking in positive experiences, leaving only hopelessness for many of our clients. Our podcast today is going to introduce a new way of thinking about shame from a neurobiological perspective. We're going to reframe shame as a survival strategy driving somatic responses of automatic obedience and total submission. We could learn to help our clients relate to their symptoms with curiosity rather than automatic acceptance, discriminate the cognitive, emotional, and physiological components of shame, as well as integrating somatic parts work, CBT strategies to transform the shame-related stuckness that many of your clients experience. And we're going to do that with trauma expert, Dr. Janina Fisher. Her trauma-informed stabilization treatment, known as TIST, doesn't ask clients to connect with the memory or emotion of a traumatic event. Instead, her approach works with the client's relationship to that emotion rather than the feeling itself. So you'll never feel as the trauma therapist like you are re-traumatizing your clients. Janina Fisher is a licensed clinical psychologist and former instructor at Harvard Medical School. She's an international expert on the treatment of trauma and disassociation. In addition to founding the TIST method, she is on the advisory board of the Trauma Research Foundation. Janina is the author of Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors, Overcoming Self-Alienation, and Transforming the Living Legacy of Trauma, a workbook for survivors and therapists. She specializes in integrating mindfulness-based and somatic interventions that she'll talk to us about today into trauma treatment and working with severe, complex trauma by helping survivors befriend their traumatized, fragmented selves in a gentle, loving, and non-pathologizing way. I learned so much, and I hope you will too. We will be back after our enlightening talk with Dr. Janina Fisher. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. So happy to have Dr. Janina Fisher, who in the trauma world is a superstar. And this topic today that we're talking about is an often requested topic: shame, how it presents in the therapy room, and what do we do as systemic therapists? How do we work with it? But Janina, the first question is always, we'd like to hear about your therapeutic origin story, specifically how you got interested in working with trauma and our focus today, shame.
I was inspired to really devote my career to trauma as a pre-doctoral intern. Actually, I think the first week of my internship, I heard Judith Herman give a grand rounds. And she said something I've never forgotten. She said, "Doesn't it make more sense that our clients suffer because of what has happened to them rather than because they have infantile fantasies. And I just remember thinking, yeah, that's absolutely right. Of course, people suffer because of what's happened to them. At the time, we thought about trauma in terms of fear, in post-traumatic stress terms. And this was a very new idea, because up until the very beginning of the 90s, trauma was assumed to only happen to soldiers in war and to sexually assaulted women, and nothing else was considered traumatic. So in 1989, when I started out, no one thought child abuse was traumatic. Child sexual abuse was something that was never mentioned, never thought about, never considered as trauma. We've learned a lot.
And what do you think makes shame such a difficult thing to work with, both from a therapist and a client perspective?
And this is actually why I got interested in shame through the treatment of trauma, because what I saw over and over again, what my supervisees reported over and over again, is that clients could resolve a number of effects of their trauma, but the shame would keep them stuck. It was like a giant barrier. It was a boulder in the middle of the road. They could not get past. And then I became curious about what is it about shame that creates a barrier to full recovery? Because as these are wonderful people who think they are trash. And of course, all therapists start out by saying, of course you feel that way because you were treated that way. It has no effect on shame.
You can validate people all day long, and that does not take away their internalized feeling of shame.
Exactly. So I began to think about it in terms of what we know about trauma. And first of all, shame is a physical response as much as it is emotional. And so this physical response aspect of it makes it harder.
Body keeps the score, right?
Exactly. The body keeps the score. And also, shame feels very personal. If someone feels fear, it's easy to say, I feel fear because of this external person or thing. Shame feels like it's all about you. And so it's very hard to separate it from a sense of your essential being. It's also a survival response. Shame is part of the animal defense of submission. And submission is crucial for the survival of children. Most, if not many, victims of domestic violence. Anytime the person being traumatized is powerless, submission becomes the only possible response. You can't fight, you can't run, you can't cry for help. You have to submit.
What you're talking about is very powerful. What is now something haunting the client is something that was once adaptive and kept them alive. And that great reframe, when you first lay that out for people that have sat in their shame for so long and not had a way to voice that, do you find them buying into that of what was, again, a survival instinct at the time, even though if it's no longer adaptive, or do they reject that?
It takes a while. I usually start out by saying, shame is an ingenious survival response. It was so smart of your mind and body to go to shame. And then usually look at me like I'm nuts. They say, huh? But that huh, that confusion tells me that I've opened up a little crack in what I think of as their bubble of shame, right? They're stuck in the bubble of shame. And when I say, oh my gosh, so ingenious, so brilliant, it completely confuses them. And there's this momentary opening. And then it has to be, it's such an automatic response. I have to keep challenging it session after session, but not in the trying to raise their self-esteem kind of way. Because as you said, they will refute every positive thing we say about them. So I have to talk about the shame as a thing. So there's them, and then there's this thing that helped them survive.
We externalize the shame.
Yeah. And I say, where would you have been without the shame? What would it have been like to live in your family and not feel the shame? And often they get chills of fear up and down their spines because it's so scary to think, what if they had not been ashamed? Because again, the submission is part of what helped them survive.
You said something else a couple of minutes ago that I think the way classic cognitive behavioral treatments for trauma or PTSD-like symptoms is expose them to the fear. And we believe that once you take care of the fear, everything will be okay. But I like to think of it that the shame is what remains even after the fear subsides. So if you don't deal with the shame, the person can't really function in an optimal way in their own life, in important relationships. Do you think that shame and self-esteem go hand in hand, or are they different?
It's interesting because the research on shame says that they're different, that self-esteem is related to our self-evaluation of what we actually do. Shame is connected to a condemnation of the whole person. I've had plenty of shame clients who could say, I'm good at my job, or at work, everybody asks me for help because I usually know what I'm doing. Those are self-esteem markers. It doesn't change the shame. The belief is that they're two totally different things, and that we, the therapist, we confuse the shame-based beliefs like, I'm stupid, I'm failure. We confuse those with low self-esteem.
So we're clearing up some of the myths like shame is actually adaptive and it's a survival mechanism for those traumatized. In doing your education to therapists and your powerful clinical work, what do you think some other major myths surrounding shame are?
I don't know that I'd call them myths. It's more kind of a mindset. I would say that most therapists assume that their clients want to be more visible, more and more successful in the world, more acknowledged. And actually, one of the effects of trauma is to be afraid of visibility. And shame is very useful, really reinforcing the impulse is to be invisible, because the classic shame response, we flush bright red, and then we want to curl up in a little ball and not be seen. And so that not be seen response is an extremely adaptive response, right? Animals in the wild do the same thing. They curl up and try not to be seen.
Yes. And you're talking about now this kind of instinctive response, which, you know, on the show, this is a audience of frontline clinicians, but understanding the neurobiology behind shame. We've had Deb Dana, Stephen Porges on the show before. And without going into a deep dive, one of the things I like about listening to you is you can distill pretty complex neurobiological concepts down into something that is manageable both for frontline clinicians and their clients. So could you give us a little neurobiology of shame 101?
What Alan Shore says about shame, he doesn't consider shame an emotion. He considers it an affect regulator, i.e. it's there to regulate other emotions, and it acts as a brake, as a braking system. He's particularly interested in the fact that shame comes online when we start to walk. You don't see shame in babies, but shame in toddlers. And you can see in toddlers that it's when mom says, no, there's this little, really 30-second shame attack, and the child kind of steps back or pulls the arm back and doesn't touch the stove or whatever. And so that Alan Shore believes that we have that built into our biology because shame is one of the quickest ways to inhibit behavior, right? Fear and shame are the two quickest ways to inhibit a behavior. And so Shore says, just for the survival, imagine the little toddlers in caves and primitive cultures. There were a lot of dangers those toddlers faced, and it was necessary for the survival of the tribe that the toddler be able to stop immediately before doing something dangerous. And if you think, then you extrapolate that to an abusive environment where the child is at risk for looking a certain way, for having a certain facial expression, certain body language, saying anything positive or negative. And children have to be able to stop on a dime when they hear a tone of voice or they see a look on a parent's face. And shame is right there as an instinctive reaction.
I've heard you say that old adage, should children better to be seen and not heard. That is the adaptive response in this neurobiological survival instinct of shame, right?
Absolutely. The easiest way to be seen and not heard is to have a shame attack. And also, one of the things that particularly interested me about shame and when I began to study it more was that we can all feel shame. It's not, it would be very hard to find somebody on this planet who's never felt shame. But most of us feel ashamed because we made a mistake. We put a foot in our mouths, right? We did something that was negative or was perceived negatively. Trauma survivors get triggered by feeling by all of those things, by mistakes, etc., but also from being successful, feeling happy, feeling proud, self-asserting. All those things trigger shame too.
Yes, that I don't deserve to be happy. I don't deserve to be successful. So actually, again, paradoxically, a good thing with a positive valence can trigger a shame response.
But the interesting thing is the belief comes after. So what we see is shame has often been a survival necessity, shall we say, in the client's life since the client was a small child. Now, as an adult, it's not a survival necessity, but all those years and years of automatic shame, when children start to put words to the shame, which again, for young children don't put words to feelings very easily. When they do start to put words to the shame, of course, those words reflect the feeling of shame. So the words are things like, I'm stupid, I'm ugly, nobody would ever like me or love me, I'm worthless, I don't deserve anything, are very characteristic beliefs. Those words make sense in a traumatic environment because, of course, children are made to feel that they don't deserve anything. They're made to feel worthless. And so those beliefs develop as an explanation for this physical, emotional reaction. And then the beliefs start to reinforce the shame response. And that's when I see clients stuck in what I call the vicious circle of shame and more shame. As if they think the words, I'm worthless, it's going to trigger a shame response. If they have the shame response and they say the words, I'm worthless, it reinforces and re-stimulates the feeling of shame. So they're caught in a double whammy.
You're also highlighting, I think, is a shift in the field when, again, we're working with trauma through cognitive behavioral means. And I think the shift in the last 15 or 20 years, certainly influenced by work with like you and like-minded people, is this somatic response, that the body reaction. And then that, as you're saying, is a part that is vital in the kind of understanding and treatment of that. The other thing, as you were telling, we'll have some listeners saying, okay, we're making a case here in the first part of our talk of that the shame happens in somebody that has something bad happen or perpetrated on as a child. What about, I'll give you an example. I am working with this one gentleman who had just got out of a prison. He was drunk one night years ago and was driving and had a wreck and unfortunately took the lives of two passengers. In this case, that was a traumatic event for the man, but he had no one perpetrate on him. In fact, he had a life of privilege before and it was all taken away. So I'm wondering how we view shame through this trauma lens if you were not perpetrated on, if you did not have something happened to you as a child.
That actually reminds me of John Bradshaw's concept of healthy shame versus toxic shame. Because what you're describing is someone who did something that we should all have healthy shame about. I drove drunk, even though I should have known better, and I killed two people. So that's healthy shame. He apparently has toxic shame, meaning he has shame that's not going to do anything. And so that's the distinction I use with clients. I say, ooh, these beliefs you have about yourself, those are toxic. This is toxic shame. And it's not going to bring anybody back. It's just going to kill you. So how can we make use of your shame? Not the toxic shame you're swimming in. How can we use healthy shame to help you become the person you were meant to be rather than the person who made this terrible mistake and paid for it?
Yes. And this gentleman, I believe by the time I met him, he was in prison for upwards of 8 years and he was a model prisoner. He got out early and he certainly felt good about his service in there, which in some ways he could acknowledge that he was looking for forgiveness from the family of the people whose lives he took. And because he could not get that from them, he spiraled back very quickly. So I think part in our talk here today is framing the work as in something that you can control and not that you give the power or the outcome based on other people's responses, right?
Yes.
This work is inherently interesting to anyone working with clients that have survived trauma. And I'm wondering your thoughts, as many of our listeners will see couples and family. So, you know, when you work with someone, I imagine much like anything else, this doesn't happen in one fell swoop. You have to have a strong alliance. You have worked with the person. The shame comes down. And I always use the metaphor of instead of knocking the wall down with a sledgehammer, just like you take it down brick by brick and work in a way. And hopefully that shame or vulnerability is not going to be used against you. I'm curious your thoughts of doing this work with a survivor of trauma and then how they translate it to their loved ones, either in a session where a partner or family member is a witness or outside of the session.
What we're doing with shame is changing the client's relationship to the shame. So that the client, it's not that the client will never feel shame again, but when the client feels the shame, A, they know they're triggered, because that's a very important link to cut, right? Our classic shame client gets triggered by something. Coworkers all clap because the client did an amazing job, and the client is overcome with shame. We have to help clients, rather than interpreting that shame as, I don't deserve to be honored, I have to help the client interpret it as, oh shit, I got triggered. Right? And to understand it as an instinctive reaction or as feeling memory that will get triggered by things. And to start putting the attention on what's triggering the shame rather than on the beliefs that reinforce the shame. And I can't convince clients not to believe those things, but I can help them change their relationship to the beliefs in their families, in their relationships. It's very interesting, because the research on shame shows that people who are shame prone tend to be less empathic and angrier than people with lower shame. Interesting that high shame is not associated with empathy. Imagine if you are the spouse or child of someone with high shame, and this parent is very quick to anger if the child or the spouse triggers the shame. And that shame can probably be triggered by many things. I'm thinking of a client of mine who used to get triggered when her kids hugged her, and she would push them away. She'd say, no, I don't want to hug you. You can just imagine the effect on the children. I often do want to talk with families, with parents, about the fact that fear and shame are very efficient ways to discipline their children, but have these very long-term consequences. The parent might want to shut the child up at age 4, but doesn't want a child who can't utter a peep at age 25 or 30. I have to help parents understand that it's a very long, frustrating process to get children to cooperate if you don't use fear and shame, but the consequences are much better.
Yes, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts of working around couples where one partner has done the work and has reframed their shame, but still, even though they feel supported by the therapist, especially if it was something like sexual trauma or something when they were younger, and they don't want their partner to think differently about them or see them in a different way. So they have done the work with you individually, but they are reluctant to tell their partner. How would you deal with a situation like that?
Done the work is a whole, means very different things, I think. In my world, it doesn't actually mean telling what happened, that doing the work is not about the events. It's about the effects. It's about being aware when one is triggered, aware that triggered reactions may not be consistent with reality, like learning to differentiate the reality from the post-traumatic perception, being able to feel positive feelings without going into shame. So to me, that's the work. And at that point, I think the spouse doesn't have to know everything. The client does have to say, I'm sensitive to certain things because of what happened to me when I was young. But because that makes all the difference. the actual disclosure of the offense does not necessarily change the relationship in a positive way. It can, but often what I spouses report is I told my story. My husband didn't think it was a big deal. That could set off tidal waves of conflict for a long time. I think it is important to help couples see that their partners need information. They don't necessarily need every detail, but they need information so they're not stepping on landmines without knowing it. And I mostly talk to couples about how they trigger each other, because that, again, keeps it more neutral. Nobody's doing anything wrong, but everybody's getting triggered.
Speaking of triggering, well, we get to Salat. I train a lot of professionally young and chronologically young therapists. So it would seem to sit with someone in their shame and be able to do what you've talked about this hour, the therapist would have to have a pretty good hold on their own shame. What are your thoughts about self of therapist work on their own, whether they be countertransference or interface issues around shame before trying to do this work and be an agent of change and healing?
I think therapists who have wrestled with their own shame really understand the shame client. And what I find usually triggers the countertransference is a walking on eggshells response, being afraid to challenge the client because of the fear of triggering more shame. I really try to be, I mean, I certainly empathize, but I empathize in a reframing kind of way, right? I empathize with, wow, this shame is so painful. You paid such a high price to survive your childhood, right? I know we have to thank the shame for having your back when you were a kid, but boy, is it tough now. And I try to, this is, may sound terrible. When I say this, I always think, oh my God, they're going to all think I'm a bad person. But I try to keep things light and humorous. So the client comes in a cloud of shame, and I laugh and I say, oh my God, doesn't it suck to live with that shame, right? What an uninvited guest. Rather than focus on the pain of the shame, one of the things that we can do, which can be both easier and harder for therapists who struggled with their own shame, is to help the client regulate. Remember, Alan Shore says, shame is merely an affect regulator. It's just there as a braking system to keep us more quiet, subdued, etc. If I can help the client regulate using the relationship, humor, facial expression, body language, pacing of the session, if I can use those to help the client regulate the shame, that gives the client the experience of being in a human relationship without shame, not every single minute, but the experience of relating to themselves and someone else without the shame dominating.
This has been an amazing overview to shame. That is a nice preview of what our listeners could get in trainings, both from you live and on demand. Give us a very brief introduction to your model, trauma-informed stabilization treatment, also known as TIST.
Yes, it's very exciting. It's a model I've been developing over many years, but more recently in the last 4 years, offering trainings. It's a parts model, but it's a trauma-informed parts model that integrates concepts and techniques from internal family systems, from thematic therapies, from clinical hypnosis, CBT, right? It's really a lot of different contributors. In the TIST model, we treat the shame as a part, as that child.
An exiled part for our IFS fans out there and listeners. A very young part.
Very young part. And usually shame is a relationship between a critical part and an ashamed child. Often I ask the client, when you say, I'm worthless, is that an accusation or is that a feeling of being worthless? And often they say both. And we begin to see it starts with the critical part saying, you're worthless. And then the child part feeling this overwhelming shame. So now the client can have a relationship to the shame that's actually a relationship to two parts, not one emotion. And it's much easier for clients to have empathy for that ashamed child, especially when they hear the critical part bashing the child.
Janina, for those interested in following up, as I imagine there will be many, what is the best way? Talk about your website or how our listeners can access this type of training.
Yes, going to my website is probably the best way to find out more about trainings and about other programs that I might be doing. And also there are lots of things to download that might be of interest to you or to your clients.
I can't thank you enough, Janina Fisher, for being part of the AMFT podcast. It was a true pleasure and honor to get to speak with you this afternoon.
It was a pleasure to speak with you, Eli. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. You can go again to Janina, J-A-N-I-N-A, Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R.com, where you can find all of her trainings and workshops upcoming. Online, you can get a Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors, which is the training in her TIST model. There's also an upcoming presented through PESI Complex Trauma Certification, Level 1 and 2 with Janina. There is Integrating Somatic Techniques in Therapy. And there's a Therapeutic Approaches to Intellectualization and Avoidance. If you're interested in trauma, AAMFT can help you out. In fact, if you are a member of AAMFT or thinking about joining, one of those special interest networks is MFTs Working with Trauma. As the field becomes more aware of the prevalence of trauma across the lifespan, the need for trauma-informed, systemic-based therapists is greater than ever. So the MFTs Working with Trauma Interest Network exists to build a network of MFTs from trauma-informed to treating trauma with competency. And this network is open to MFTs at all levels, whether you're interested in increasing your skills or networking with others. There's online resources, like I said, networking, web-based trainings, a review of the public resources used by AMFT during trauma events in the community that happened in recent years. And there's the evaluation of the state of trauma education and training requirements. So you can join during your renewal process. I know I renew my AMFT membership every fall, so you can do it then. Or you can renew mid-cycle. Just go to aamft.org, networks.aamft.org/trauma/home. We'll take you right there. We love hearing from you on the podcast. You can check out all the back seasons wherever you get your favorite podcast. I like Apple Podcast and Spotify. And there you can see, as we referenced today, you can go back and see our interviews last year with Stephen Porges and Deb Dana from the Trauma World and Polyvagal Theory. Janina is a colleague and fan of Dick Schwartz, one of my original mentors. You can go all the way back to the first season and listen to our interview with Dick Schwartz as he talks about IFS. We love feedback from you. You can get a hold of me, Eli at NorthstarCounselingCenter.com, or also ELIKARAM.com. Did you know the AMFT is also active on your favorite social media channels? So be sure to follow the AMFT on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. You're a returning listener. We thank you for your continued support. And if you're new today, as Janina has a big following in the trauma world, if you're tuning into us for the first time, thank you so much. And we hope you will check us out again in the future for the latest and greatest in all things systemic therapy. Until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.